You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 3rd, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, and for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, investigative journalist for Bloomberg Businessweek, Peter Robeson, author of Flying Blind, the 737 MAX tragedy, and the fall of Boeing. Meanwhile, Senator Ben Ray Luan, who had a stroke and just underwent brain surgery, is expected back in the Senate in 4 to 6 weeks. And in that period, Senate Democrats won't have their majority, so just a reminder of how tenuous this all is. The Biden administration is deploying 3,000 more troops to Eastern Europe, NATO's eastern flank. And the reminder that Ukraine is not in NATO, but the U.S. likes to use their potential membership, which will never happen, as a tool of antagonism. Labor groups have come out against Jim Clyburn's pick for Breyer's replacement, J. Michelle Childs. I think this public rebuke makes it a lot harder for Biden to nominate her, which is good. The leader of ISIS has been assassinated, apparently, by the U.S. in northern Syria, and that changes very little. But their air raid also reportedly killed 13 civilians, including 6 children, according to the Syria Civil Defense, so a new ISIS leader will emerge, but those civilians will still be dead. Thousands of Afghans are seeking refuge in Iran and Pakistan daily as the country's economy collapses under Taliban rule. Estimates show that over 1 million could be fleeing the country. Today marks the 60th year anniversary of JFK implementing a full U.S. embargo on Cuba, which Obama attempted to roll back a bit and then Trump strengthened. It's accomplished nothing but misery. These are some positive headlines today. And lastly, doesn't get better here, at least 60 have been killed in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Africa's second largest nation, after an attack by militant groups on a camp for displaced peoples. Around 5.6 million remain displaced in Congo as of the end of last year. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out today, but it's Thursday, so we have a great and potentially even better show for you. Sorry to be all doom and gloom with those headlines, but I mean, putting the suffering of human beings outside of our country into context is very important, and sometimes it can slip our minds when we get a little bit too invested in U.S. politics. I mentioned that drone strike, or the air raid, I should say, and Bradley, if you could just pull that up. There are differing reports coming out right now about how those 13 plus potentially civilians died. The U.S. military is essentially saying that there were explosives that were accidentally detonated that didn't have anything to do really with their air raid. I find that claim to be quite dubious, specifically.
Well, we know the credibility of the U.S. military.
I mean, in a few months, it'll come out most likely that maybe those claims aren't necessarily true. There have been reporters on the ground that have spoken to people in northern Syria who were affected by this. Bradley, if you could pull up that account that you showed me earlier from one of the civilians. So this reporter, Joe Dyke, spoke with one of the people who witnessed this air raid. The planes came around 1 a.m. There was a first, second, and third floor. They were shouting that we needed to get out of the house, men, women, and children, and that we would be killed if not. They fired a missile / shell while we were inside. Then they fired bullets, and we were inside. Then my husband went out and my son. They said, get away from the house and lie down on the ground. I came out behind them, but I didn't see them on the ground. They said, put your hands up on your head and get on the ground and take off your hijab. I was very scared. I couldn't tolerate it. Then they took my children and get inside. Then I took my children and get inside. They say, you will die, you will die. Then they threw a missile inside, a second one. My husband said they want to destroy the house. Let them. Don't move. I went out. They took the kids from me directly, and they searched me and handcuffed my hands behind me. They took me over there under the tree. There's a second part here. The neighbors were there as well. They hit my husband and hit my hair. Honestly, the neighbors don't know each other. I only know Abu Ahmad's family. The interviewer asked when they were shouting to you with loudspeakers, did they mention the name? No. Then the planes above us started to hit the top floor with machine guns, meaning that the man couldn't go down to get out. He couldn't get out or his children. And the person who being interviewed said, I saw the remnants of bodies after they hit it and his son died. He still had two daughters and a 15-day-old son. The father and mother and brother were killed, and the kids survived. Kids were a girl around 11 years old, a girl 7 years old, a boy 4 years old, and a 15-year-old boy were taken out. So, as Joe Dyke says in that thread, Biden is going to speak about this raid any minute now. It might actually already be happening, and he's going to claim enormous victory. But a reminder that a new leader of ISIS will emerge, and these people will still be dead. And that's the reality of what the United States and the Pentagon claim are victories in this war on terror. But let's also turn to the way that the Pentagon has responded to the Amnesty International report about Israel. So Amnesty International is the latest human rights organization to call Israel an apartheid state. It's important because Amnesty International is probably the world's largest human rights organization in the world. I believe that Human Rights Watch has already declared Israel to be an apartheid state. I think anybody with eyes and who has an understanding of what's happening there believes that that is the case. It's been 54 years of occupation. Palestinians have tiered ID cards while Israelis can move freely. Palestinians cannot participate in these elections that affect their lives. Israelis can do so freely. Israel can revoke the residency status of Palestinians at whim and without any real recourse. There are a variety of clear indicators of apartheid, let alone the fact that the ports are controlled by Israel. The water supply is immensely tainted in the occupied Palestinian territory. Clean water is very hard to get. Palestinians are killed in these conflicts at a disproportionate rate. We could go on and on. But here is this reporter, the AP's Matt Lee, who has gotten into scuffles with Ned Price before. He asks Ned Price here how they can use the Amnesty International reports in other instances as a way to bolster their claims about human rights abuses, but then ignore and take no issue with the report on Israel here. And Ned Price does not appreciate this question, but I very much do.
Outside reports, but you certainly cite them quite a bit in your own human rights report. And I went back and looked, and you know, in terms of just the last human rights report cited Amnesty International on Ethiopia, on Cuba, on China and Xinjiang, on Iran, on Burma, on Syria, on Cuba, and that those references are endorsements of what this group, Amnesty, and then other groups as well that are cited as well, have found. Why is it that without taking a stand or making a judgment about the findings of this particular report, why is it that all criticism of Israel is from these groups is almost always rejected by the U.S. and yet accepted, welcomed, and endorsed when the criticism is of other countries, notably countries with which you have significant policy differences?
Matt, I would make a couple points. Number one, when we include a footnote in something like...
These aren't footnotes, Ned. These are...
When we cite, yes. Which it's a game of semantics, I suppose, but whether you call it a citation or a footnote.
Well, when it says in the report, Amnesty International found this X in Xinjiang with the Uyghurs, and we determined that we think that it's a genocide, and you guys come out and cite that and say, well, we also agree that it's a
that
genocide.
That is a far cry, Matt, from saying that we have a comprehensive agreement with a third-party report that's produced by an outside group.
So it's just when it's criticism of Israel that you feel free to disagree?
Let's
go.
Have
you ever disagreed with an Amnesty report or a human rights report on a country such as Iran?
This is not, Matt, this is not about any outside group. This is about our vehement disagreement with a certain finding in a report by an outside group.
Okay.
There are plenty of times where we cite, as you said, outside groups in our own reports. We cite the facts that they have uncovered, that they have put forward. But I don't think you're going to find any citation in any State Department document. And I don't think I'll regret saying this. It says the department agrees on a comprehensive basis with absolutely everything that's in this report.
Yeah.
Like he's acting as if there's like it's like a small thing in like the report. The main
calls a footnote.
Yeah, it's no the finding of the report with that Israel is an apartheid state, which has been recognized by more and more groups, frankly. And that's not some minor thing that you can have a disagreement with. Like, why do you have such a vehement disagreement with it? It's because you are on the hook for them with in imperial alignments.
Yeah, I have the report right here. It's multiple pages. It's not a footnote. And here it says, a system of apartheid is an institutionalized regime of oppression and domination by one racial group over another. It is a serious human rights violation, which is prohibited in public international law. Amnesty International's extensive research and legal analysis carried out in consultation with external experts demonstrates that Israel enforces such a system against Palestinians through laws, policies, and practices which ensure their prolonged cruel discriminatory treatment. That is the facts of the ground. That's not a footnote, right? I know he's just talking about his own report, I believe, there. But
he's trying to minimize it.
It's semantics. Yeah. He's trying to minimize it as well, where Amnesty International held a press conference. This should have been done a long time ago, but they put the weight of their credibility behind this accusation, and the fact that Amnesty International has this built-up international credibility. The United States is happy to use that to their own imperial ends, to bolster their claims against China because they want to create this Cold War kind of dynamic with China in order to create more competition, which gives more money to industry, specifically defense contractors in some areas as well. So that serves their interests. But calling into question the U.S. funding of Israel and the apartheid and the squalor that we create and the systems of oppression that we continue to uphold internationally while we clutch our pearls about what's happening in other countries, I mean, let alone our funding for Saudi Arabia, which is currently committing massive human rights violations in Yemen as well as domestically in their own country. We're happy to use Amnesty International's credibility for our own purposes. But, the reporter here was calling out that obvious hypocrisy, and Ned Price has no good answer for it.
It shows why the State Department is not a good vehicle to join with people in these concerns, because they don't share them. It's just a warrant for them to do what they want to do in certain places. So yeah, people get upset about certain areas. This fine, we'll keep this lesson. And every time the State Department draws out something, I think there should be skepticism towards it, frankly.
Yeah. Never take what the government, especially dominant imperial governments, say seriously. I mean, that is a great rule of thumb. Unless it is backed up by activists and facts on the ground, often, I mean, it's the same thing when, by the way, every news outlet takes Israel's claims about the Iron Dome at face value. The fact that it stops 90% of Hamas's rockets. That is just the Israel Defense Department. I don't even remember exactly what it's called, but that is the Israeli government saying those statistics and repeated by every news source out there. That is a way to uphold the Iron Dome funding and in fact increase it and get U.S. officials to increase Iron Dome funding, which has now just happened, even though there is very little understanding of the efficacy, because the efficacy of Palestinians' rockets are, it's pretty much zilch. They randomly go different places. And so then it also muddies the waters, and it pretends like there's a false equivalency between this power dynamic, just to bring it back to this Amnesty International report. Is it not a one side versus another side? It is a system of domination and repression, and that is always how it has to be framed.
And the Amnesty International report is not radical. It literally, I think, goes as far as saying we're not taking a position on the occupation. We're just trying to, you know, use words correctly, and apartheid fits.
Well, they have, exactly, and they have other constituencies that they want to appease, which is why it took them so long to do this in the first place. But the fact that they did so, given their size, should show how obvious this is. All right, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by the author of Flying Blind, the 737 MAX tragedy and the fall of Boeing, Peter Robeson. We are back, and we are joined by investigative journalist for Bloomberg Businessweek, Peter Robeson. I apologize for mispronouncing your name earlier in the program, author of Flying Blind, the 737 MAX tragedy and the fall of Boeing. Thanks so much for being here, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So I loved your book, and I honestly, the Boeing post-crash propaganda campaign has kind of worked, because I realized in, you know, reading some of what you wrote, that I had largely forgotten about these twin crashes during a 6-month period a few years ago. So if you could remind, and we can start there, our audience a little bit about these two crashes of these Boeing 737 jets, and I guess then we can work backwards, talk about the history of Boeing, as well as its merger and why that led to some of these oversights.
Sure. It is, you know, as you say, people have in some ways forgotten about these two crashes, which I think is partly just because of our need for a reliable air traffic system. People desperately want Boeing to be safe and reliable. So it's hard to imagine that it isn't. But the reason I wanted to write this book, and the reason why I think it's still important for people to think about, is that Boeing's behavior after the first crash was extremely unethical by its own standards. The airlines at American Airlines, one of the largest airlines in the world, were telling Boeing that they had hidden a dangerous piece of software that had the power to take the control of one of the most widely flown planes in the world from the hands of pilots. And Boeing, you know, was set to its mission of keeping the MAX flying, of blaming what happened on pilots, and continued to push this narrative that it was the pilot's fault. You know, even went to Congress and told Congress people that it was the pilot's fault. And in Ethiopia, the pilot tried to follow the new checklist Boeing had designed, and again, the software took the plane out of his hands, and another plane crashed. And that's when Boeing's story fell apart.
It reminds me a little bit of how when Wells Fargo was opening up all of those accounts, accounts for and pushing all of those separate accounts to be created in order to inflate their stock prices, how they blamed it on the middle bank managers for issuing or for following through on the directive from corporate, which was create as many accounts for as many people as possible, and that means that our stock prices are going to go up. I mean, that it seems to me that that was Boeing strategy as well. Let it fall on the individual pilots. Don't look up. Don't look at our corporate culture and what we created here.
That's a really interesting parallel. And you saw that with the pilots on the ground at Boeing who were asked to carry out what the management called the program directive. And the program directive was that the new plane, the MAX, when Boeing designed it, you know, shall handle the same as the other plane and therefore shall not require additional training, you know, by the airlines, which would be expensive. And Boeing had promised one of the biggest customers, Southwest, that it would pay them $1 million a plane if it did need additional simulator training. So pilots on the ground reacted as you would expect them to. They downplayed any idea that pilots needed additional training, that this was a new feature that required flagging to pilots. And then the executives responded in much the way, you know, in the example of you highlighted with Wells Fargo, they blamed it on people beneath them.
So let's start with the history then of Boeing a little bit, because I think it shifts clearly with the 1997 merger, but first it has to build up all of this like credibility and cachet in the United States, and also just in industry. It became immensely important in the post-World War II America. So talk a little bit about the history of the company, if you could. Like, I wasn't even aware that Boeing is the manufacturer of Air Force One, for example.
And that's with the 747, which is, you know, still considered one of the most iconic planes ever made. I started covering Boeing in the late 90s at the period of this merger with McDonnell Douglas, when the culture did shift. But before that, it was considered one of the greatest American companies, certainly, you know, one of the greatest manufacturers. It had almost single-handedly created the jet age by taking risks, by investing in products like the 707, which was the first successful commercial jetliner. And it did that by focusing on manufacturing, by focusing on product, by putting engineers first in the culture. There was a saying in the 60s at Boeing that, you know, we hire engineers and other people. The designer of the 747, Joe Sutter, you know, had great sway throughout the company for much of that history. But then what I saw when I started covering Boeing in the late 90s was this shift in culture, and it was because Boeing had decided to imitate the corporate model that was then being promoted by Jack Welch, the standard corporate playbook of putting shareholders first.
And that shift happens with this merger with McDonnell Douglas, which was famous for cost cutting, and basically they seemed to adopt a lot of their policies. Talk a little bit about how that merger with that company specifically, and Harry Stonecipher, their CEO, how that affected the company. And I mean, it appears to me that you can kind of get away with some of these anti-worker, cost-cutting, anti-safety measures on a smaller scale. But when it happens at a company like Boeing, when this merger happens, that's when it becomes really catastrophic.
Yeah, it is a combination of things, as you're saying. It starts with people. Harry Stonecipher worked for Jack Welch at GE for years, and he imbibes, you know, the mentality of it's a business, not an engineering company. Ultimately, what matters is to make money for shareholders. And Boeing's incentives. One example is that Boeing's incentives started to change. I noticed in proxy statements that they talked a lot about customer service and safety in the late 90s. And then by about 2007, the focus was on cost containment and efficiency. And managers were rated, you know, based on how well they contained costs. And when the MAX was developed, The Boeing sent a presentation to the board that was headlined, you know, stingy with a purpose. And they congratulated themselves on how much money they weren't spending at almost every step of the way.
So talk a little bit more, if you could, about the dynamic of, I mean, the dominance of shareholder value as the number one priority in corporate culture, specifically gaining traction in the 90s. I mean, to me, it's very much a function of late stage capitalism and neoliberal policies that have allowed for this. But when you have a company that has its customers' life in its hands, like Boeing, you see some of the more deadly consequences of shareholder value above all.
Yeah. And another thing that happened right at that period of the merger in 1997 was the corporate roundtable, the lobbyists for the biggest companies like Boeing and Wells Fargo put out a statement that said that the company's first duty is to shareholders and shareholders alone. And it was, you know, it was almost uncontroversial at the time because it was a time when GE was soaring and its profits were going up 50% a year. Its stock price was going up 50%. It seemed to be that the late stage capitalist model, people didn't talk about it as late stage then. They just thought this was the way it should be. It seemed that this late stage model was the way to run a company. And Jack Welch at GE was hollowing out the manufacturing base. He was focusing on services, not products. He was, you know, he had this rapid fix it, close it or sell it mentality. There wasn't patience in investing. And over time, it's become clear what the drawbacks of that are. And even in 2019, the corporate roundtable corrected its previous statement or issued a new statement and said that companies owe a duty to communities, to employees, and to customers as well as shareholders.
So then I guess we can move into the post-1997 Boeing era and how the company grew in its relationship, even with the government as well. Take us to that period and how, if you could expand a little bit on how things began to shift.
Yeah, there was a parallel shift that was happening in government as well. And it's one that I describe in the book. Through the eyes of these specialists at the FAA who were seeing these changes on the ground. And starting in the 90s, you had Republican leaders who were committed to reducing the size of government. And that was mingling with this, you know, triangulating desire of the Clinton administration to reinvent government. So starting in the late 90s, there were attempts to run the FAA more like a business and to reward managers based on their success in meeting the needs of stakeholders. And the stakeholder is the manufacturer, it's the airline. And it steadily moved more toward self-regulation. By 2005, the FAA had handed over much more authority over the certification of new planes directly to Boeing. And it used to be that the FAA appointed these deputies at Boeing who certify that each aspect of the plane is safe. And in 2005, the job of picking these deputies went to Boeing, and the FAA would have this sort of vague oversight role. And the specialists I talked to at the FAA said what happened is that their own managers started working together with Boeing managers to get planes out on time, to meet deadlines, and they couldn't get their points listened to.
I mean, when you say it out loud, it sounds, I know that this is like kind of common practice. I mean, we see this under many Republican administrations, specifically like the EPA. Okay, you know, why don't you self-regulate coal plant? But for something like airplanes, where we've become almost numb to the fact that these planes are flying us through the air at rapid speeds and any minor issue, if it results in a crash, hundreds of people die. I mean, what was that process like of the FAA basically saying, you're developing these relationships or maybe even coming from the industries that they're supposed to regulate and making these decisions, which in my opinion probably should be illegal, that these companies should self-regulate? And how'd that look, I guess?
Yeah, it's really relying on the industry's record of safety over time. And that was almost taken for granted. And the head of the office who oversaw Boeing, named Ali Barami, would tell specialists that, you know, it's okay. Boeing knows the rules. Boeing can handle it. There was this deep trust in Boeing having this enlightened self-interest to protect it itself. And Barami later, you know, got a job at the industry lobbyist making $300,000 a year. So there's a lot of belief in enlightened self-interest, in enlightened self-interest, but it comes across often as simply self-interest.
Would you say that it's a coincidence that Boeing was also at this point developing weapons and like working with the Defense Department on other projects outside of commercial airlines?
It was becoming a huge player in Washington. I talked to one executive who was marveling at the size of the lobbying shop. This person had been along with Boeing all through the rise from it being a Seattle aircraft builder to now suddenly being, after the acquisition of McDonnell Douglas and other companies, being this massive defense contractor as well. So it's still the number two defense contractor. So that plays a role also, but Boeing often gets what it wants in Washington.
Right. It's depressing. I mean, I don't think people don't fully connect how unpleasant their flying experience is to government regulation. If the government wanted to, they could say the seats have to be this big. You can only have this number of people on airplanes. You know, there can be some more protections for the customers on these airplanes. I know that's maybe a bit separate from the manufacturer. That's more with the airlines as well. But that it seems to me like it wasn't just with the airplane manufacturers. Airlines were also getting the kid glove treatment from the government during this time period too.
Yeah, and those are things that perhaps in times past would have been considered unremarkable for the government to have a say in those things. But this idea that we should leave it to corporations, that their profit and their position in the industry, you know, can't be tampered with, partly because we're in a global race against other economies, that message is just transcendent right now. So it's hard to see how the government would have a role as small as that at this point.
Right. Okay. So then I guess we can move into some of the defects and the manufacturing issues with Boeing's planes, despite the FAA clearly developing some sort of cozy relationship with Boeing. They still did cite Boeing as for some safety violations in the 21st century. That was 20 safety violations. So that means that they were obviously cutting corners even past the low standard that the FAA was holding them to. Can you talk a little bit about this new era of Boeing airplane and kind of some of the stories that you wrote about in your book of pilots having issues, planes not meeting these safety requirements, and how things turn there?
Yeah, I tried in many cases to compare, you know, the number of safety violations Boeing had compared to Airbus, because at this point they are pretty much the same size, although Airbus now has 2/3 of the narrow body market and Boeing has 1/3. It's completely reversed from 20 years ago. But that number of safety violations, you know, compares with a handful at Airbus. And there were moments where, I talked to specialists at the FAA who wanted to get additional safety measures put on the MAX. You know, one was surge protectors and circuit breakers on the fuel tanks on the MAX. And, you know, one specialist I talked to was told by his manager that no, you know, what Boeing had was enough to meet regulations. He didn't agree, but he noticed that on the Airbus plane, that the competing Airbus plane, that change was required to be made. And, you know, again, it emphasizes this cozy relationship and the way they were working together to get the planes out the door, not hold the manufacturer's feet to the fire and make sure it's safe.
And so would you draw that discrepancy to Boeing's lobbying efforts as opposed to a company like Airbus?
That certainly plays a role. And I think it's also reflecting the shift in the corporate culture. It's no coincidence that not just the MAX, but you know, virtually every big Boeing program has had problems. The Air Force has been deeply critical of quality issues with the refueling tankers Boeing built for it. The 787 has been largely grounded for the past year because of manufacturing defects. Some of this is coming out because the FAA, you know, does feel emboldened in some ways since the MAX crashes, but it's also showing that this is a company with deep problems, and that has come from devaluing engineers, and it needs to sort those problems out.
So devaluing engineers, do you mind explaining to the audience what that looks like in contrast with past or best practices?
Yeah, I mean, the broadest example would be, you know, maybe one that I describe in the book, which is that after a crash of the 747 in 1985 in Japan, Boeing almost immediately took responsibility for it and said this was the result of a faulty repair job on our own factories, and that touched off an effort over years to look more closely at quality by the customers. But Boeing designed a plane called the 777 in the 90s that's still considered one of the safest ever to fly. It had a culture called it, you know, sort of self-consciously created this slogan, working together. And the idea was that Boeing would work together with customers, with suppliers, with employees. There would be communication, people would listen. And that plane debuted in 95, which was shortly before this big shift in culture we talked about. And since then, the engineers, talk at Boeing, talk about not being listened to. And that came out even after the first crash of the MAX in 2018. Dennis Muilenburg, the CEO, didn't even give a hearing to the idea of the pilots. He told one of his executives that these union pilots simply wanted to make more money to fly the plane. So things were responded to with ideology, not with a belief in the ground truth of the engineers.
And did you see this coinciding, this new attitude, with a more aggressive anti-union push as well?
Yeah, even in the unit that developed the manual, which was found to be insufficient for the MAX, had been riven by these fights over unionization. And Boeing had taken the simulators in this unit and moved them to Miami, which people there felt was a direct response to their unionization efforts. And so at the time, there was fragmentation in people's jobs. Instead of walking a few floors to the simulator to chat with someone about a new procedure, they had to call someone in a hotel room in Miami, where there were increasingly contractors who weren't getting the same messages at times. There were problems with miscommunications. That Boeing called them purchase service pilots, or PSPs, and the longtime pilots called them DBCs, which was short for dirtbag contractors. So that gives you a sense of the hallway conversations at Boeing.
Right. And I mean, that can't even be efficient, but like, I guess it appears like you're cost cutting. And another thing you wrote about, which was not shocking to me, but of course depressing, was the amount of billions in stock buybacks that were given to these executives, as opposed to going towards improving the technology of these planes, despite these issues. Talk a little bit about how expansive and how large those buybacks were.
Yeah, I mean, and this is a big part of the Welch legacy. And buybacks always sound arcane. They always seem ephemeral to people. It's hard to grasp what it's doing. But what it's really doing is diverting the cash of the company you know, directly to shareholders and especially to the executives at the top who are compensated in large part in stock. And GE in the 90s started sending half of its cash to shareholders in the form of dividends and buybacks. At Boeing, while the MAX was being developed, that hit 80%. And over 5 years, it was $40 billion. So, and that's money that, you know, Boeing was budgeting $2.5 billion for the MAX. It could have developed a couple of new planes with that amount of money.
And so I guess that brings us to the aftermath of these crashes and the amount of compensation that was, or not compensation, I should say, but the settlements that were reached with some of the victims of these crashes, and also the United States government's response. Take us through that, if you could.
Yeah, the final penalty in this deferred prosecution agreement that the government reached was a headline figure of $2.5 billion, which people I talked to thought was very unusual that the Justice Department was putting this headline figure on the settlement, because it included money that Boeing, about $1.8 billion that Boeing was going to hand to customers as compensation for their losses. That's money that Boeing was required in the settlement to pay, but it was likely going to pay that anyway. It was also in negotiations at the time with families. It was ordered to, you know, pay them another $500 million, but that, you know, that's split over hundreds of people. So, and the final piece of the settlement was $243 million. The actual cash part was $243 million, which the government said was the amount Boeing saved by not requiring simulator training, which gives you an idea of what, you know, what could have been avoided if the right thing had been done in the first place, and what the real stakes were if people had stopped to think about what they were doing. So ultimately it's an agreement that lets Boeing go on doing what it's doing. The only criminal action is against a mid-ranking pilot, and the families are, you know, deeply, many of the families are deeply upset about how this was handled. And they asked for a meeting with, you know, the new Attorney General Merrick Garland to say that their views weren't heard on this settlement.
And let's also be clear, too, that Boeing also received billions of dollars in bailout money in the pandemic. I mean, what was that final figure, and especially in comparison to what was paid out to these victims?
Well, it's the airlines, its customers got bailout money in the pandemic. Boeing, you know, the timing may be unrelated, but Boeing was given, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in relief payments from the Air Force over these delays on the tanker, which was, you know, relief ultimately. And Boeing was able to raise debt very cheaply from investors. So, you know, just going back to what you were saying at the start, it's the companies can do wrong, but they're still protected because of their huge role in the economy.
Yeah. I mean, and lastly, I guess you've been covering this company since 1997, you say, right? I mean, like, I guess I'm curious about your 30,000 foot perspective on where the airline industry is and where such a dominant player like Boeing is, in terms of like its role, and if it's learned any lessons, and if there's any silver linings to some of the things that you researched.
Things move very slowly in the aircraft industry. So it's hard sometimes to see the forest for the trees, but when I started covering Boeing, it had 2/3 of the market. As I say, it was widely praised. It had a great reputation around the world. The FAA was the gold standard of regulation. And now Boeing has about 1/3 of the market. Airbus has the hotly, you know, desired, you know, narrow body plane. Its assembly lines are almost full. There are new aircraft makers in China and Russia that are trying to take a piece of the market. That's going to take a long time, but Boeing perhaps is looking like a smaller company that is having a harder time competing on the world stage, which is the story of American manufacturing ultimately.
Yep, absolutely. Well, I really appreciate your time today. Everyone can check out this book. It is entitled Flying Blind, The 737 MAX Tragedy and the Fall of Boeing. Peter Robison, also investigative journalist for Bloomberg Business Week and author of this book. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Yep. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the first hour of the show. We are back. I wanted to touch on this story, and yeah, I know half the audience is going to be like, ugh, sports, but it's really not about that. There, for people who may be unaware, the Chicago, well, it is about sports, but it's more about owners and their inability to face the consequences of their actions or be challenged in any meaningful way. The Chicago Blackhawks, an NHL team, one of the original six NHL teams, considered one of the top franchises in the league, has been mired in a massive scandal in which one of their young players during their Stanley Cup run around, I believe, 10 years ago or a little bit, or 2010, was sexually assaulted very aggressively by a video assistant on staff. Kyle Beach was the victim's name. He was John Doe in a lawsuit for a while and came out and spoke incredibly powerfully to the media, told his story, talked graphically about this assault by this video assistant who was kept on with the organization after Kyle Beach complained because they didn't want to disrupt team chemistry in the middle of a Stanley Cup run, which they ended up winning. The idea that a video assistant would be protected, this isn't the head coach, not that that would be okay, this isn't the general manager, this isn't the owner, this guy was a video assistant who was also able to participate despite saying, okay, after this year you have to leave, but he was kept on, participated in the team celebration after they won the Stanley Cup, then was let go, went and worked in other programs, including with other young boys, ended up getting convicted, I believe, of assaulting a minor at another point in his life. He's a convicted sex offender, and the Blackhawks helped cover it up. This is a massive, massive story, and yet the entire organization appears to be frustrated that the media is even deigning to ask them about this story. Here is a reporter from The Athletic, which was, I believe, recently acquired by the New York Times, Mark Lazarus. He's asking the chairman, Rocky Wirtz, who I believe is also the owner of the Blackhawks. Is that right, Bradley? Yes. He's the chairman. Just double checking on that. Yes, he's the owner.
Yeah, he's the principal owner and chairperson of the team.
Look at how indignantly he responds and how outrageously he responds when there's a question about the team's culpability in this really, really disgusting incident.
I know we're looking forward here, but I think we have to look back also, and I think much of what happened to Kyle Beach stemmed from a power imbalance between a coach and a player and the powerlessness of a player in that situation. So what are the Blackhawks doing? What have the Blackhawks done? What will the Blackhawks do to empower a player in a similar situation to make sure that doesn't happen again?
I'm going to answer the question at the end. I think the report speaks for itself. The people that were involved are no longer here. We're not looking back at 2010. We're looking forward. And we're not going to talk about 2010. I'm not either. And we're not going to talk about what happened. We're moving forward. That is my answer. Now, what's your next question?
I can pick up to what we are doing today. And I think
That's none of your business. That's none of your business. What we're going to do today is our business. I don't think it's any of your business.
How is it not my business?
Because I don't think it's any of your business. You don't work for the company. If someone in the company asks that question, we'll answer it. And I think you should get on to the next subject. We're not going to talk about Kyle Beach. We're not going to talk about anything that happened. Now, we're moving on. What more do I have to say? You want to keep asking the same question? You hear the same answer? Okay, ask the next question. Okay, good.
He had to apologize after that, because obviously that outburst was incredibly embarrassing. But the reporter nailed it. The athletic reporter, when he said, you said enough right there. The guy's name is Mark Lazarus. It's a sports story, but it really is a corporate culture and capitalism story.
It's a capitalist story,
yeah.
An accountable capitalist.
Mm-hmm. This guy feels, team owners operate like oligarchs, and they feel like they are, we're seeing this also in the story of Brian Flores, where someone like Stephen Ross basically said to him in the NFL, you're going to tank, and I'm going to pay you I'm going to pay you money to be bad at your job, and I'll probably throw you overboard in the end, and it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, you'll be fired because of the bad record.
Because you'll be fired because of the bad record, but I paid you to do what I wanted. I wanted you to be the worst team in the league, and you do it, and you'll be the fall guy, and it doesn't matter if you're trying to like represent something bigger than yourself, and it's your entire career, and you're a black coach, and it's already hard for you to get opportunities, but you're going to do what I say, because I'm a billionaire, and I own this team. And like, this is the similar thing that we're seeing here there. Like, you are an outside reporter, and you're going to ask me about what meaningful changes we've done in our organization to prevent sexual assault? You're not in the company. You're not a company guy. You're not getting paid by me, so you should not be able to ask me any tough questions. And the idea that anyone getting paid by him would be able to ask tough questions is laughable because of the instance that we talked about here. Because when Kyle Beach, who was, I believe, 19 at the time, he struggled. He talks about how he had substance abuse issues after this assault, because no one in the team listened to him. He went to multiple people, and there was a meeting about it, and everyone decided to cover it up, to keep on a very ancillary coach to the team's success. The idea that anybody in the organization would have been able to go to that guy, that capitalist, that owner, and say, I really want to talk about the structural power dynamics within this organization, which we spoke about indigenous rights and the offensiveness of those mascots yesterday. Blackhawks, you're up next, by the way. The idea that anyone in that organization would be able to actually meaningfully say something to the powerful, it's laughable. And that he demonstrated that by the way that he spoke to that reporter.
Yeah, that's sort of owner. That's who's coddled to it in this America. That's who's threatened by all the wokeness. That's like when Dave Rubin says, like, the wokes are coming for your boardrooms. That's what he's talking about. Like, that's who's in his ear. That's who Dave Rubin thinks he's like representing, basically. And I think it's coming up in so many different areas in sports, but also that, happened in entertainment a lot too. But the SI reporter, I forget his name, Mike Silver, I think.
Yeah.
When he said like there are racists in position of power, or, people who are willing to cover up sexual assaults, or like just bad people in positions of power. And we need to stop, tiptoeing around people like that.
Yep. So good question by that reporter though. Anyway,
Yeah, and it, like the reporter said, he wasn't even asking about the past. He was saying, what are you doing now and in the future?
Right. Right. The answer is nothing.
The answer is, I'm not talking about it with anybody unless you're part of the company. And if you are part of the company, I'll fire you. So you're not part of the company, so you can't.
But if anyone's in the company, we'll talk about it.
Yeah. We'll talk about it in a way that's like you're fired.
Yeah, right. All right, we are going to wrap up this first hour of the show and head into the fun half. Good mix in the first hour today. We talked about massive amounts of death in the countries that the United States has meddled in, then corporate malfeasance, and now sexual assault.
Yep, and you know, military strikes too.
Yeah, it's just with a potpourri of horribleness.
Binder and Brandon, if you want to join us, the link should be in your chat.
For now, what happened, Matt, on Left Reckoning last night?
We actually had Matt Binder on Left Reckoning to talk about his new show, Scam Economy. We had a big, long discussion about the new hit piece Spotify NFT thing that upset a lot of artists. Binder had a theory that it's the sort of thing where it's easier to say sorry than ask permission. Mm. And we also talked about Leonard Peltier and how Biden needs to free Leonard Peltier. And anybody who has looked over the legal circumstances as to why he spent 44 of his 77 years in prison will understand that it is just to send a message to activists that if you are an activist, you can get locked up too. And so Biden should do it. I hope he does do it. Like people like Danny DeVito have been.
I was about to say pressure. He tweeted out. You're right.
But, you know, if he doesn't do it, it will be because the. Lawless law enforcement community, FBI, Biden doesn't have the courage to cross them, and they'd rather have a guy, you know, spend his entire life in prison to send that message to folks who might want to protest things these days. So we talked about that, and also how the bipartisan infrastructure bill, you know, it's nice that we're getting some money to bridges and stuff like that, particularly in the wake of the Pennsylvania bridge collapse. However, even the governor of Pennsylvania says the federal funds are not going to do enough to close the gap for infrastructure even in Pennsylvania. So we're not doing nearly enough, and it was just a kick of the can down the road. And, you know, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see the Democrats try to run on the bipartisan infrastructure bill because, again, like I like that particularly the bridge stuff, bridge repair, that's needed. We need, frankly, a lot more of it, and it can't be once in a lifetime, as Nancy Pelosi said, because that bridge in Pennsylvania was only 50 years old, and I don't know about you guys, but I want to live longer than 50 years. So anyway, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get all of that, and here is Binder himself.
Ooh. Very prompt. 1 o'clock on the nose. Or as Sam's other computer says, 12:55 or whatever. Hey, Matt, how are you? Yep, no audio.
Getting an audio issue, Matt.
Yep. Just go to your
chat.
There we go.
How are you guys?
Doing well. I mean, you're probably sick of Matt. Other Matt, our new Matt already, huh?
Oh, yeah. Long time no see, Matt. Had fun last night on Left Reckoning. It was great.
Yeah, it was very, very fun.
Yeah, he just gave us a little bit of the lowdown. What's happening on Doomed and Scam Economy?
Right. Well, tonight is going to be another episode of Scam Economy. Doomed is taking a very, very short break. In fact, next week will be a very special episode of Doomed with a very special guest. I don't know if I can say it yet, so I'll wait. But a lot of you who watch this show will know him because he's on this show almost every day. But
that is that's makes it pretty obvious.
Yeah, I mean, just make it sure. No, we already emailed back and forth. We're pretty sure we have the date down. It's definitely happening. Tonight, though, youtube.com/MattBinder, and then obviously as a podcast at scameconomy.com. We will once again be diving into the scam economy. This time we'll be specifically looking into more about how cryptocurrency in general is a Ponzi scheme and how stablecoins, specifically Tether, are basically enacting possibly the biggest market manipulation of all time. I had on Sohal Mortazavi, who wrote a great piece for The Jacobin. Which really another, you know, for the early episodes, it was really good because it really does a great job of breaking this down for the layperson who has no idea about cryptocurrency. And that's what I'm trying to do, at least early on here, because it could get confusing. That's not what this show is here to do. We're not going to confuse you. You'll get all you need to know and understand it all.
Amazing. All right. Well, I can't wait to check out the next episode of Scam Economy. Do we have Brandon?
No, we might need to do Brandon's plugs after the break.
Are we going to do our new fun half?
Oh, really, really quickly, can I just thank everybody for subscribing to the show and supporting it last week? Because of all of the Majority Report listeners, the show skyrocketed on the tech Apple podcast charts. And like we were in like the top 10 for a number of days. So I really wanted to thank you all for helping out there and supporting the new show.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, I'm so happy that it had a great launch. Very good stuff. But I guess we'll head into the fun half. The only reason I said that was we all need to play the new one, but Bender might appreciate it.
It will be.
Oh, I saw it.
But Bender won't be able to see it this time.
All right. Well, 646-257-3920. I didn't even read that. I just remembered that. It might have been the first time. I don't remember phone numbers anymore. The only phone number I know by heart is my mother's.
Wait, is it 646-257-3920?
Yes.
Nice. Okay.
Good. There you go. So if I'm ever in a pinch, my emergency contact, my mom, she doesn't pick up, I'll call into this show. All right. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this,
7-8? Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go for a walk.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.